Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. This is Zachary Strebeck, your host and your resident game lawyer. Today, I am talking with Mike Gnade from Rock Manor Games. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. It's kind of short notice. I had to shuffle the dates around.
We had to change dates a few times, but it's okay.
Yeah, but it's great to have you on. Usually the first thing I do on the show is start off by discussing your background, how you got started in the games industry and what you did before, or maybe what you're doing now.
Wow. I've sort of had a long history in the game industry. I sort of started doing something in the game industry back in like 2008. Mm-hmm. I actually founded the Indie Game Magazine website. So we were like covering indie games sort of when no one knew what indie games were and they were blowing up.
Very cool.
So I sort of had my own website and magazine. I ran a site called Indie Game Stand that distributed indie games for a while
before selling that.
So that's sort of what I was doing. And, you know, whether I was press or talking to developers for the website, I was going to a lot of conventions and things, of course. And it was at a PAX or some convention like that where I was tired from walking around looking at all the video games and my feet hurt. And I made it to the back and wanted to sit down. So I sat down and played, some tabletop games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, loved it, had a great time sort of spending the Sunday and the last days playing a bunch of tabletop games at PAX, and then was inspired to start creating my own games. I sort of was always a pseudo wannabe indie game developer digitally, but I'm not a great coder or artist. So, when you're looking at a video game, you need to be able to code, you need to have art, you need to have animation, you need to have music and sound effects.
Right, right.
There's a lot more pieces that go into a video game. So when I was inspired in the tabletop space, I felt like it was a lot more approachable because I basically needed the game design part, which I felt I could do. And then I could do some of the graphic design from my days working on the magazine and mm-hmm. doing that. I was proficient in a lot of that stuff. So then the only thing I really needed was art. So it was like a lot less sort of hiring or like employees. There were a lot less moving parts, I felt. So that's sort of how I started. I made my first card game and then followed it up with another game that I sort of recently kickstarted. So that's sort of how – that's been my long journey sort of in the games industry so far, I guess.
Excellent. So you didn't design or publish any games before you started your own company, right? You jumped
Correct.
Right in.
Wow. Correct.
It was because you had kind of an entrepreneurial spirit before then. Were you afraid to start your own game company? I mean, what would drive you to jump directly into that before?
Everything I'd done in the indie game industry up to that point was on my own, like creating mm-hmm. my own job to work in the game space. Mainly because of where I live and, I live on the East Coast, south of Philly, and Philadelphia is one of the only major cities in the United States that doesn't have a AAA game studio. Huh. So we have some indie game studios, but, we don't have like Boston has Harmonix and Austin has a bunch of places and, yep. San Francisco and Seattle obviously have a bunch and Toronto has Ubisoft and, these other major cities all have sort of a game studio you've heard of, and Philadelphia yep. is this sort of enigma that it doesn't. So I needed to create my own job to sort of get started in general. And obviously I worked, a full-time job somewhere else. But eventually in 2010, I started my own sort of IT company and was an entrepreneur, and that was successful enough that I could sort of do all these side projects and these other entrepreneurial ventures. So
That's sort of
a 10-year synopsis in what, 2 minutes or something.
That's perfect. I'm actually from outside of Philadelphia as well, so I had no idea. Very cool. I'm from South Jersey though, so maybe a little further outside than you. But I went to art school in Philadelphia at possibly the worst art school ever, but it's still.
Oh really?
Yes, I went to
which one? The one right there on Broad?
No, that would be a better art school. That's University Arts. That's University of the Arts. I went to the Art Institute of Philadelphia, which was a, you know, for-profit. This is for, you know, the stigma was on the for-profit universities, I guess. This is decades ago. But I went there. I mean, you know, I learned. I got a job making, doing animation after that. So I guess it prepared me for a short career as an animator. But yeah, I don't think it gave me the training that I would have needed to really excel. Anyway, I'm a better lawyer than I am an artist.
Okay. Well,
I'll
yeah, I
tell
mean
you that.
that picking arts is tough, man. I mean.
Yeah. Very difficult. Yeah, you kind of have to be the best of the best. That's why I like the indie space so much, is that, you know, anyone, it's sort of maybe not anyone, but it's democratized a lot more, and anyone can make their own game as long as you have the
I agree.
drive to
Yeah,
get it done.
I agree with the democratized, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't necessarily make a good game, but anyone can make a game and get things done.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Yeah. All right. So so it's been, what, about 2 years that you've been in business doing tabletop games?
I mean, around this time last year was when my first game was like actually available to like non to like Kickstarter backers, and like, you know, it got here from China, give or take. I mean, it was like July or August, sort of. So it's sort of been a year since I've had a game out. Obviously, like leading up to getting the game out is a long period of time. I wouldn't say I was in business at that time. But I sort of leveraged what I was doing in the video game space and attended cons and got my first game out there enough that obviously was kickstarted, you know? Like I sort of did enough to get it kickstarted, and I learned a lot from that process, which made me infinitely more successful the second time around.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you, well, yeah, I don't think you mentioned the names of your games. You might as well do that.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. My first game is called Brass Empire. It's a steampunk deck building game. Pretty competitive. You know, I grew up playing like Magic and BattleTech and games like that back when I was in middle school. So when I play, I love deck builders when I discovered them, but I felt they lacked player interaction and sort of that competitive nature that I like so much. And, you
Sure.
know, games like Magic or Hearthstone or BattleTech or wherever, where you're like really trying to not only build your engine, but sort of like make sure the other players don't catch up, you know, to you.
Yep.
So I built a deck builder from the ground up that's built to be a lot more interactive, you know, whether it's through the cards that you're building, where you can like steal victory points from other players, or I mean, in Brass Empire, you're actually like playing and constructing like steam-powered contraptions that sort of act as creatures and can attack and sabotage the other companies that you're playing against. So it's sort of like a ruthless steampunk like world of, you know, business and corporate greed and corruption, sort of. And then my most recent game that I sort of just kickstarted back in May is called Maximum Apocalypse. It is a cooperative game that's sort of different post-apocalyptic themes, different missions and scenarios. It was inspired by a lot of like the randomly generated indie games that I love and play, and a lot of things I encountered in video games, where there's sort of a randomized level and map that you can navigate, and it's sort of different every time you play. But you sort of have rules to like generate sort of the starting point.
Yeah, it looks awesome. This is more my style, I think. So I may have to pick up a copy. Excellent. So how is business so far? What's it been like being an indie board game publisher?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, my first Kickstarter, you know, I made some mistakes. The biggest mistake I think I made was that you know, I went to these conventions. I went to a convention. I mean, I was attending conventions, sort of covering indie games, indie video games. And I think I went to one convention that I got in to sort of publicly show Brass Empire before the Kickstarter. So I sort of thought the game was done. Publicly showed it at PAX Prime. Got a good reception. But then, like a month later, went to Kickstarter, and I think if I had spent a year, like I did with Maximum Apocalypse, like showing it to conventions, and refining it, mm-hmm. I would have done a lot better. You know, I mean, not only would have I exposed it to more people, but it would have had more iterations. I would have made it a little bit stronger.
At the point when you're running a Kickstarter, how important is it that the design is almost there, right? Or maybe it's not too early.
I mean, that's completely debatable. So, the biggest thing for me, and one of the things I'm really proud of, is that even though it was my first Kickstarter, mm-hmm. I delivered my game to my backers in less than 9 months.
Excellent.
So it didn't take a year. It didn't take 2 years. Like, one of the things as a Kickstarter, like, not as a creator, but like as a backer, that I hate is when you back a game and it's like you're waiting. Yeah. I mean, there's video games that I backed like 3 years ago that I still haven't gotten. Or like, you know, I think we'll never be like finished, quote unquote.
I back them and forget them. I mean, even by the time it takes the money out of my account, I've already forgotten that I backed the game. And then I just put it out of my mind for the next year or whatever. And then it shows up.
So, I mean, I'm okay with a year, you know, I mean, I think a year is reasonable, but you know,
the people are going to be,
you know, when I have these games, it's like, I backed this 4 years ago and I still don't even have like a beta key.
Yep.
You know, and that's not every, indie video game, but that's just like a common problem. And, you know, there's a lot, I mean, board game developers have varying opinions over how finished a game should be when you take it to Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. My strategy has been that 90% plus of the primary artwork needed to publish the game is finished before I take it to Kickstarter. Okay. So I think my games come to Kickstarter a lot later than some games hit Kickstarter, but that's the only way you can deliver a board game. I mean, a video game is one thing. You could have a working alpha, take it to Kickstarter, and those people could play that working alpha the month after the Kickstarter's finished, right? It's digital distribution. You know, there's a lot less headaches as far as that goes. Whereas a board game, like, you need to, like, it's going to take you at least 3 months to, like, manufacture and ship it, you know, and get it on a ship to the United States, let alone the fulfillment, packaging everything and like getting it to backers. So you need, in my opinion, you need to be much further along in the process to deliver the game on time, or in a reasonable time frame. I think, you know, if you leave some artwork done and you have an artist who's really fast, you may be able to take it to Kickstarter, keep the artist working on stuff and like get it within a year. But that's part of the problem with tabletop games and why you have to wait so long or wait a year or whatever is because the games aren't quite finished. The artist still needs to finish stuff up and they run into manufacturing delays and shipping delays and other things that sort of naturally happen. And you know, for me, especially with these Kickstarter games that are now like $80 plus you're paying for actual shipping. It's like, you know, that's a lot to ask.
I agree.
To wait a year on $100, you know, it's, so I take all those things into consideration from a backer standpoint. When I take things to Kickstarter, you know,
yeah, so, that makes sense.
I try to deliver faster and for me, you know, while it's not true for all the creators out there, for me, the game is essentially done when it comes to Kickstarter. You know, there's some final artwork pieces. We need to sort of maybe touch up the production files, maybe change a number or two on a card. But there's no drastic changes that are made to the core structure of the game during or after the Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's the strategy I've heard from a lot of at least sort of veteran Kickstarter game developers and publishers, that the game is almost ready to go when they do the Kickstarter. And then that's just like gauging the interest, getting the pre-orders basically, and then starting the manufacturing.
Yeah, one of the advantages of having the sort of first game and Kickstarter I had is that while I had that game in stock and to sell and was taking it to cons to show, I could mention that I was working on a second game, potentially play test it, you know, for people that I thought would be interested in it. And I sort of had it in my back pocket as I attended these conventions, you know, over the year since my first Kickstarter was like in my hands, which was helpful, you know, to sort of have something else to talk about and work on, you know, at conventions, behind closed doors with designers or whatever else.
When you're at these conventions, are you getting people's email addresses, or how are you keeping in contact with them? I'd imagine that.
Yes.
Building up a big mailing list, right?
I mean, yeah, nothing revolutionary there. I basically bring a clipboard with a piece of paper on it that asks for email address and sit it on my table or booth or whatever. Sometimes after someone demos a game or plays a game, I may say, hey, I may point the mailing list out to them. Mm-hmm. I typically have some sort of like handout or postcard that I can give people that has the website and, I could potentially get an email sign up sort of after that. But yeah, it's traditional newsletter signups for sure.
In basically all internet-based marketing and in-person marketing, the email is still the number one thing, I think. You know, forget about liking your Facebook page or, you know, following you on Twitter. I don't think any of that stuff is as sticky as having someone's email address and being able to send something.
The conversion rate on sending an email newsletter and email is way more effective than tweeting about something on Twitter or anything else, for sure.
Right. You had mentioned you have about 90% of the art done before you launch the Kickstarter, but what if you're a first time Kickstarter creator? Maybe you don't have a ton of money and that's the reason you're going to Kickstarter. I mean, is there a sort of a balance of where you need to be as far as artwork goes?
I mean, here's the thing. In my experience, if you have, in my experience with when it comes to like artwork, right? I mean, really any product, you know, and I don't even know where I heard this years ago. Maybe it was in my master's in economics school in college or something. But this one idea stuck with me, and I think it's very true, that when you're buying a product or service, there's three aspects to that, to any service or product, and you can only ever have two of them. There's price, time, and quality. So if you want to get something cheap, you can't get it fast. If you want to have something cheap and fast, that's fine, but the quality is going to suffer. If you want great quality and a good price, it's going to take longer. You know, if you want a good quality in a fast time, you're going to pay for that. You know, you're going to pay for those things. Yep. You're going to pay a higher price. So I think that's 100% true with artists, especially, one, there's so many artists that you can find on the internet, and that's how I found the artists for all my games. And for my first game especially, I didn't have a ton of money, and I wasn't super confident in what I was doing yet, and I was just learning. And I didn't put a ton of money into the art for Brass Empire. I think the quality I got for what I spent was fantastic. And how I did that was I found a student who was in a fine arts program who priced himself lower and, took longer. I mean, it took us probably like 8 or 9 months while he was going to school to get all the artwork done. Mm-hmm. But what you can do with that time, especially if you're a new creator, is you can attend conventions, refine the game, and just iterate on it and build that mailing list and build that crowd you're going to bring to Kickstarter. So I think for a first-time creator, it's actually to their advantage to say, I need to have all the artwork done for the game. And then when their game's done, when they think their game's done, try to find an artist. Find an artist that you can afford. Find an artist that is probably going to not be that fast, but gives you a good value and a good price. And then spend the time that the artist is taking to do that artwork, as a side project in their spare time, et cetera. Not a professional artist who is looking for like a 40-hour gig to do artwork, and is going to charge you $150 plus $100 an hour. Find somebody who can do it in their spare time for fun, like you, where you're working on your game in their spare time for fun, and spend that time going to conventions or finding your game and building a crowd, playtesting the game. And then as you're playtesting, you'll get artwork will come in. You can make your prototype look better, show it to more and more people. And I think that's a really good experience for anyone who thinks they can be a tabletop designer publisher. The other route is if you really don't want to spend money on the art and you think you have a good game, is to go to a convention and pitch it to a publisher.
Yeah.
Whether it's a small publisher like me or whether it's a bigger publisher like, Fantasy Flight Games or something like that.
Yeah, because generally if you come to them, they generally say not to have art when you are pitching it to publishers because they're
just exactly
redo it anyway, right? It's a waste of money.
Right, 100%. So if you're at that point where you think your game's really done and you don't have the money to do artwork or you have no interest in doing some of the more businessy things and you want to strictly be a game designer, you should 100% go to like a speed dating event at Gen Con or Origins and try to sell to a publisher. Or make personal connections, just attending cons, playtesting the game. You're going to make personal connections. I mean, the first game we're publishing that's not a game I designed is from a local designer who goes to our Game Makers Guild of Philadelphia meetups. So, you know, one of the games we have in our pipeline is, you know, an acquaintance slash friend colleague that I have who's, we've been playing each other's games for like a year, you know, monthly as we go to these meetups locally to help each other out.
Awesome. Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually. If you were the sole designer or you're planning to publish other designers' games, is that something you want to see as sort of a 50-50, like half of them are going to be other designers' games and then the half of them, do you have more of your own ideas that you want to publish?
I do. So the things I'm working on now are a little less game design intensive because I've got about 65 to 70% of the artwork done for the Brass Empire expansion.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that the art will finish up over the summer and we can take that to Kickstarter sometime in the fall. And then I'm publishing this game from Todd Walsh locally called Set a Watch. That's a cooperative. It's a new game. And you know, I played this game probably for the first time like 8 or 9 months ago. So, I mean, it's really the game from a game design perspective, I felt like it was really far along and I've sort of added my, as a publisher, I've added some of my, I've helped design and make some changes and tweak things,
as is your right.
which I think have streamlined the game, and Todd's been great to work with. So I'm getting really excited about that game. And we just started producing the art for that game. So I think that'll sort of be next. And then the other thing I'm working on as a designer is that the Maximum Apocalypse, sort of the first expansion. I built that game especially, like I said, over 2 years. And it was sort of a very grand idea. And I think a lot of the hard work I put into it has paid off. And it was designed to be very modular. So as part of the Kickstarter, we were doing the first expansion, but I'm working on a much larger expansion. I'm actually working on 2 more expansions. And the artist won final touch-ups for the production, the mass production of the artwork now. Like, he's immediately, we're just going to keep working together. Excellent. On Maximum Apocalypse. So I sort of have 3 things in the pipeline, but I have met people going to all these conventions and sort of getting involved in this space over the past year that I think will yield other games as well. Not to mention sort of some of my own prototypes that I do have, you know, do have sort of clanking around as well. I've been sort of working on a game, and you'll appreciate this, on a law game, a game that focuses around one person playing the prosecution, one person paying the defense.
Excellent.
And I'm probably going to either co-design that with Samuel Bailey or sort of give him the lead designer reins and just sort of let him take my idea and run with it. We're gonna meet up at Gen Con and sort of talk about it again. But we're definitely working on that project together. It's way too early to really talk more about it other than it's going to be based on a court case.
That's so cool.
And you'll be like picking the jury and, you know, doing things that you do as a lawyer.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, it sounds like you have a ton of things going on. How do you manage, how do you have the bandwidth for all of this? Are you still running your IT company on the side or?
No. I do work a lot. I'm not going to say that the work and hours I put in are for everyone. You know, since I've been an entrepreneur over the past 7 to 8 years, you know, I tell people, you know, the great thing about being an entrepreneur, you know, instead of being told the 40 hours a week you need to work, you know, as for a full-time job, right, you choose the 60 hours a week that you
exactly
work.
Exactly. As an entrepreneur myself, I understand.
You know, a crazy thing I did was my second kid, my wife was my wife was due with our second kid right around when I launched my second Kickstarter. Wow. But
congratulations.
So, now, first of all, my daughter helped me out and was 9 days late. So the first first week of the Kickstarter was free and clear of any infant, you know, responsibilities.
That's the crucial times.
But, but I will say that despite that, I had basically been working my ass off since the start of the year, preparing a lot of things. I sold my IT company on March 31st. I launched my Kickstarter April 7th. I had sold Indie Game Stand sort of the summer before. So I had sold two of the companies that were occupying a bulk of my work week leading up to running the Kickstarter. And while I'm still consulting and helping for my IT company, I'm not, you know, the hours I'm putting in are reduced. You know, running it versus consulting and helping the new owners is a lot different than running the business yourself. And being like a support person, being like the primary person is definitely different. So I did free up a lot of my time leading into my Kickstarter, even though I had a new kid on the way. And then since, basically selling the business, and doing all that was my wife and I sort of talked, and it's sort of like this idea of, well, I'm going to take it a little bit easier this year, just focusing on the board game stuff. And I basically have a year to figure out if it can provide, like, make enough money to be worth doing it like full time. So that's sort of the what I'm shifting into. So that's why I have so many things, sort of so many irons in the fire. So we'll see how it works out. You know, a year from now, I may be saying, you know, we've hired a bunch of people and like we're growing and we're becoming a real business, or it may just be me and I may be able to like, you know, work with freelancers and contractors and other designers enough to make it sort of work as like a sort of smaller indie business. You know, I don't know where it's going to take me, but that's sort of where we are right now. But I mean, the Maximum Apocalypse Kickstarter did really well, and I think it certainly set me off on a good path. And I'm excited about what this year is going to bring and the new games we can get going. So I'm very optimistic leading into it, but you know, I have shed a lot of my responsibility so I can focus more on this and put in a good 30 to 40 hours a week doing game design, production, logistics, shipping and fulfillment, and all those kind of things.
Well, to many listeners and many people out there, you're living the dream right now. That's great.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
But I mean, obviously doing things like podcasts and press and marketing and blog posts, there's a lot of stuff. You know, I'm not trying to make it just as a game designer. I think that's short-sighted and hard. I feel like all this experience I have being an entrepreneur gives me some business acumen that I can take to hopefully solidify, you know, a career I'd like to have in the game design and tabletop space. So I'm living the dream for at least a year. We'll see how it goes, basically.
Very cool. All right, I'm gonna bring you down a little bit here. I remember. Let's talk about Steamcraft. Do you remember that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Steamcraft is what Brass Empire once was. Correct.
Correct. So when I was showing it publicly, like PAX, and I got accepted into the Mega Booth and these other showcases, that is what the game was known as. It was changed during my first Kickstarter. The name had to be changed. So.
Yep. Because of trademark issues.
I mean, it's because of Kickstarter's IP issues. So
okay.
I mean, the trademark, you know, if you did a trademark search, it was open. I actually had started the process of trademarking the Steamcraft name. I owned the domain name steamcraftgame.com. I had been showing the game publicly for 6 months as Steamcraft without anything. And basically a guy who had made a Kickstarter years ago that had made very little money, found my Kickstarter and objected to Kickstarter about the name, and Kickstarter immediately shut me down, taking evidence that they had a Kickstarter. They had a site, you know, they basically had a page on their site with the same name. Kickstarter that had been run a few years before.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But I will tell you this. I mean, it doesn't matter how big or small it is. And it seems like, yeah, it seems like it doesn't make sense. But, you know, even if you sell more than just a few copies, I mean, they use the name in commerce. I don't know. Maybe they had rights. I would imagine they sold the game and the game went to backers and all that. So, I mean, they accrued trademark rights. So from my perspective, if I was their lawyer, I would have told them to do the same thing.
Well, they definitely, I would say that they definitely did not utilize an attorney. They basically just were emailing me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I wasn't even saying like, I wouldn't rename the game. Obviously, I was in the middle of it, so it just wasn't a high priority to figure that aspect of it out at the time. It was important to hopefully support the Kickstarter, answer all the comments and feedback, and like keep that going. Because Kickstarter has a time limit, and then it's over, and you have a lot more time to do other things. But Kickstarter is basically a full-time job when you're running it. So I was distracted by that when these emails were coming in from him, and I guess I wasn't responsive enough. And he just, you know, Kickstarter just has a form you can fill out online. So I mean, that's the level. That's what he did. I mean, look, it all worked out for the best. I actually like the new. I like the name Brass Empire better.
I like the name better too.
I'm happy. You know, like it all worked out for the best. If I was him, I wouldn't have handled it that way, especially being involved in the indie space as long as I have.
Right.
You know, I know how collaborative and democratic it is, and doing that to another creator and approaching it the way he did, I would have never done. But that's okay. Like I said, it all worked out for the best.
Sure. So I think the lesson to draw for other Kickstarter creators is A, make sure you search Kickstarter as well before you put your game up there. And then
I definitely did more of a traditional like search on the web versus
Google
search at Kickstarter. Yeah, like Google trademark office, like these legal things and domain searches, etc.
The other thing is, I mean, the problem with not having found that before you put up the thing is Kickstarter just takes down your page, right? And so you're in the middle of the campaign it screws everything up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely negatively impacted like the maximum sort of yield I could have gotten on Brass Empire, I think. But I was already funded before it was taken down, and I felt, you know, I think most Kickstarter creators and experienced people at that point would have told me to cancel and relaunch, which I considered doing. Mm-hmm. But for a first time creator, getting 100% funding, I felt it was very important to go through the process of manufacturing, fulfilling, and understanding all that, and getting the game into people's hands was really important to me at that point after having worked on the game for like a year.
I agree.
So I just wanted people to play my game, and I didn't really care about making $10,000 more or whatever, you know, whatever the negative impact was, whatever, however much more Steamcraft could have made or Brass Empire could have made, that piece of it was less important to me than sort of the on the job training I felt I could get if I just pursued it further. Right. I also feel like it was in good faith to the backers. You know, it was funded even after the problem and it was reactivated. It was still overfunded. So it's sort of shitty to say, well, I think I could have made more money, so I'm canceling and we'll try again under the new name. You know, I mean, I got the money I had asked for and more. So I should fulfill on that promise. So that's what I did. And I think I've written about some of the mistakes I made in the Kickstarter, obviously the name being one of them, but also canceling and pricing things the way I did and having the tiers I had, the way my page was structured. I made some typical first creator pitfalls that hopefully other people can learn from.
I feel like no matter how much you read as a first time creator, you're always going to make mistakes. There's going to be.
I mean, I feel like you always make mistakes regardless. I made mistakes with Max Apocalypse, even though Max Apocalypse made six times more than Brass Empire. You know what I mean? Now those mistakes were a lot. You start nitpicking the mistakes that you're making. You know, they're probably not affecting the overall campaign as much, but they're still mistakes.
Yeah, even Jamie Stegmaier, the Kickstarter master, he posts right. Blog posts about his mistakes all the time. So it happens to the best. So you mentioned your blog. You recently wrote a few blog posts about advertising, paid advertising, right?
Correct.
Can you give us kind of a summary of what you found out in your experiences?
Yeah. So, one of the things I did a lot better for my second Kickstarter was I actually spent some money on advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend who was in marketing who helped me with some of the basics stuff as well. But one of the things I really wanted to do during my Kickstarter was be able to track everything as best I could to find out what advertising was effective and what wasn't, instead of just blindly throwing advertising money everywhere. So I did a lot of prep work coming up with a marketing and advertising strategy before my Kickstarter even launched. And then I executed on it. And then now that my Kickstarter has been over for a while, I've always wanted to take all that data and share it with all the other creators out there. So I posted sort of a general overview of the different advertising places we chose to advertise and the ROI that we got on each site, sort of as a general, like if you're thinking about doing a Kickstarter, here's places you may want to consider mm-hmm. advertising, and here's sort of our result. But I've also started breaking out each specific, would you call it? Like, I guess platform? A website or like advertising platform.
You did a BoardGameGeek one recently, right?
Yeah, I did a BoardGameGeek one. I've done my Reddit post is written. Mm-hmm. I wrote about KickTrack. The only one I still need to do is Facebook. And part of the reason I haven't done that one yet is because it's the most intense and like there's a lot you have to do like technically from like a website standpoint to actually get Facebook pixels to work in their platform. And obviously they've got a very robust platform, right? Yep. BoardGameGeek, you just send them the ads and they put it up on their website. Yep. So there's not really a lot for you to do. Whereas Facebook, like how well you can use their sort of tool and their like advertising dashboard is going to affect your ROI. You can set up demographic groups. You can do all these sorts of different things. Yep. And the problem is, while Kickstarter allows you to use reference codes and put Google Analytics and Google tracking on your page, they don't let you install like the Google Pixel, which is like the Facebook equivalent of Google Analytics for their advertising platform. There's a way to sort of circumvent it a little bit by using subdomains. So all of our Facebook ads were actually sending people to a subdomain like Facebook1.rockmannergames.com, Facebook2.rockmannergames.com, and those all corresponded to different demographics in the ads. Okay. And when you hit that page, there was just a dummy HTML page that had the Facebook pixel installed and then forwarded you to the Kickstarter page. Huh. But it was at least capturing the people that were clicking the ad.
Right.
And then we could extrapolate. And then on the Kickstarter side of things, it was telling us that the incoming traffic was coming from Facebook1.rockmannergames.com instead of just Facebook.com or mobilefacebook.com, which is like a bunch of organic social traffic as well. So we knew who was specifically coming into Kickstarter from the advertising, which made adjusting the advertising during the campaign, I think, a lot more effective.
Absolutely. Wow.
As you can sort of hear, that's a lot more involved than just talking about BoardGameGeek ads and like what the results were. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that I want to inform people about sort of how we did what we did to get the results we got.
Very cool.
So I'm working on it. I'll put that up in the next couple of weeks, hopefully.
I'll have your link in the show notes if people.
If you link that main overview article once I post this last Facebook one, I'm going to go back to the article, okay. And I'll have like sort of it'll be sort of be like a table of contents at the bottom, so you'll be able to see them all and click to Reddit, etc.
Have you heard similar things from other people as far as their experiences with paid advertising?
I heard in general that Facebook ads work. Mm-hmm. From the Facebook groups so one of the interesting things I think about indie board game designers versus like indie video gamers or just mm-hmm. other marketing spaces in general is that when I was in the indie video game space, Twitter was a lot more important than it is in the tabletop space. Yeah. Facebook was still important, but in the board game space, Facebook is way more substantial than any other social media platform, in my opinion. And I don't know if it's just they have forums and there's all these groups in there. But there are indie video game groups too on Facebook, but it's just they're not. I don't know if there's just other Steam and there's these other places, and it's just not as important. It doesn't draw as much time. But I find it very interesting that like there's so many conversations going out on about the indie tabletop space on Facebook at all times. So I had heard Facebook ads worked and were important, but I wasn't sure if it was just because all these conversations were taking place on Facebook or not. But I think there is something about the tabletop demographic that tends to be a little bit more on Facebook than Twitter or whatever, the Instagram or anything else. Which is interesting because, you know, YouTube and Twitter and other things can be bigger in some of the other spaces I've worked in, you know, in past lives in business. So I knew I wanted to try Facebook ads because there was this – I felt like there was this – qualitatively, there was this phenomenon of, man, tabletop's a lot more active on Facebook than other things. So I sort of had this qualitative feeling of, yes, that's true, and people are saying Facebook ads are working. And then, of course, you know, there's – in those Facebook groups, there's constant discussion about Board Game Geek and what is worth it and what is not worth it. I wanted to put some of that to the test. So those three things I sort of decided pretty early on. And then during my campaign, I sort of decided to try Kick Track. You know, Reddit. I had always liked Reddit in the indie game space. Mm-hmm. Again, in the video game space, I feel like Reddit's much bigger. So I wanted to sort of test the waters with tabletop and board games. And ironically, their new ad platform like launched a month before my Kickstarter. So I was a fan of their old ad platform, and their new ad platform had an amazing ROI. So I certainly like the control that – I mean, I like the control that those ad platforms give you over BoardGameGeek. Mm-hmm. And the ability they give you to like tweak your ads during a campaign to – you know, hopefully more effectively, you know, make every dollar count a little bit more. I love that. So I do think that's a huge negative for Board Game Geek, but I won't get into talking about all this since you can read it, you know, in more detail later on our website.
Excellent. All right. Well, we are just about out of time. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks again for coming on the show, Mike. Excellent.
No problem. Thanks for having me. And, I guess just anybody who's interested in getting our games, you know, check out our website, rockmannergames.com. It's always better to buy directly from the developer. We get a lot bigger cut, which matters a lot in the tabletop game space. If you want our game, definitely buy it from us at conventions or buy it directly from our website. And while I'm okay with using Amazon, it's better if you buy directly from independent creators.
Yep, I agree.
So,
all right. You can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. You can read more about the legal aspects of game development and find other podcast episodes. So thanks again, Mike. And I will see all of you listeners next month.